In a moment, Sir Charles Schulz III joins us. Latest on Mars and also new energy sources wrapped up in tonight's program on Coast to Coast AM. Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems, computer-based automated test equipment, as well. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing 2 missile system, worked on the Patriot, the Copperhead tank killer, and advanced attack helicopter systems. Charles has performed research under grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence, and, of course, has written many technical publications, as you know, and articles on space, astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development. Here he is, full program, back on Coast to Coast. Sir Charles, how are you?
I'm doing very well, George. Thanks for having me on the show.
And
here's to a great show tonight.
Lots to talk with you about. Great pictures we've got that you gave us on the website on alternative energy, the sources from the sun, and we'll get updates on Mars. Wanted to ask you this, though. Just last hour, we had a caller who told us that North Korea may be testing a missile and would shoot it towards Hawaii. I went online and checked it, and he's indeed right. It could happen. You're an expert in weaponry. I mean, what do you think could happen if they start playing around like that?
Well, if there's any threat of that happening, we do have what's known as the Laser Fortress, and it's a modified 747 that carries an infrared laser. And it has the ability to pinpoint and shoot down anything we feel is a threat. So if there's any serious consideration that this is a threat, then you can be sure that the Laser Fortress will be mobilized.
Is it pretty accurate?
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, we're going to hit it if they shoot it.
Good, good. Well, that's always nice to know. What's new with Mars?
Well, it's pretty interesting. The first and most interesting thing is they're finally admitting that there is some sort of water activity occurring on Mars right now. And it took them quite a while to get around to it, but they're seeing a number of new gullies being carved in craters and valleys here and there. So it's got them scratching their heads because they're still convinced that it's not possible, but they're seeing the results of it. There also has been something very interesting happening with the two rovers. Spirit has been stuck since May in soft sand. The Spirit rover has the bad wheel, the front wheel,
right,
been dragging for years. And so it hit a patch of soft sand, and it sunk in the sand, and it's been stuck there for months now. And they don't really see an easy way to get it out, but they're still taking as much image data as they can with it. Now, Opportunity, on the other hand, has had much better success, but its right front wheel is also starting to fail. So they're trying to drive on it less often so it doesn't overheat and burn up. It's on its way on a two-year drive to a crater that's 20 times larger than Victoria Crater, and that's Endeavour Crater. And it's going to take, as they mentioned, 2 years to get there. This crater is almost 14 miles, or about 22 kilometers across. So they expect to be driving out there for a couple of years and examining what's going on the way. And it could be interesting.
Well, we've gotten our money's worth, Sir Charles, from these two units, haven't we?
Absolutely no doubt. They were scheduled to last for 90 days, and they're in their sixth year now.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, if only we could get vehicles that worked that well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're just like the Ever-Ready Bunny. They just keep going on and on and on and on.
Well, certainly. And something else interesting came across my desk here. You know, China is planning to launch a Mars probe, but they're going to do it atop a Russian rocket.
That's interesting.
That is interesting. They're getting some cooperation here, and they're going to fly their own probe to Mars and do their own sensing. And maybe they'll make a discovery that they're going to talk about that our government hasn't said anything about yet.
What's new in the fossil world out there on Mars?
Well, you know, the problem with the images is we don't have a whole lot of image data from the microscopic imager right now that's of any use. They're getting a lot of problems trying to image some of the things with a microscope under Spirit, because they're using it to see what it's stuck in and what they can do about it. They're not really using it to look at the soil in any great detail. They sent about a half dozen shots back a few days ago. Opportunity, its arm is wearing out. And so the problem is, if they fold the arm up, it may never deploy again.
Right.
So they leave it extended. Well, that has some, you know, effects on how they drive, because the arm tends to bounce and wiggle, and you don't want to break it off. They are sending back a few shots, and I haven't seen anything particularly any different from what we've seen. You know, most of the spherules still look the same. They're pretty eroded. Very few have any real significant details on them. But I do expect they're going to have to make some sort of an announcement in the near future, because they realize that there should be organic molecules on the surface of Mars, and they haven't detected them. And the reasons are the instrumentation in the past wasn't sensitive enough to detect it. The rovers don't carry instruments that can detect organic materials. And when they sent the Phoenix lander to the polar region of Mars, the engines heated the soil enough that they probably destroyed the organic molecules present because of something known as perchlorates in the soil. That literally, heating it would bleach the molecules apart.
When we landed on Mars, we did some testing of microbes. We may have cooked them. What's your reaction to that?
And that's possible. You know, well, of course, with the Viking landers back in 1976, they took samples and exposed the soil to nutrients to see if any growth occurred, and that was the labeled release experiment. And they found what appeared to be a positive result. Then they took soil and they heated it to sterilize it and did the test again, and they got no results. And that's a pretty good indication that whatever was in the soil got broken down and became non-reactive, and it was probably organisms. But, you know, as stated, they didn't even have the ability to detect organic molecules, even though they had intended to. The instrumentation was not strong enough, or I should say sensitive enough, to be able to make a real decisive reading on it.
You know, I think if we ever get to the point where we can properly test, they're going to find that there are organisms teeming on Mars.
I have no doubt of that. You know, I think that Gilbert Levin was absolutely right, and he's the fellow that designed the labeled release experiment. You know, many of the tests they did indicated an increase in organic material, but it was discarded. They said that was invalid data, and they used the reasoning of something called the pyrolytic experiment. The sensors that they had were unable to detect up to a billion cells per cubic centimeter when tested here on Earth. They absolutely were blind to the material. So the decision they made to trust that result was absolutely wrong.
What do you think of these pictures, Charles, that show what could be cities on Mars or a skull on the planet? What do you think of those?
Well, you know, I'm quite a bit of a skeptic of some of those things. And the reasoning is, when I look at the history of Mars, its atmosphere and environment, and the fossils that I've found, I don't see any evidence of anything intelligent evolving there. And I'd have to say that if we were to find cities or artifacts on the planet, they would have to be from a civilization or a people that came from elsewhere and not from Mars itself. And, you know, as you think about it, I mean, there are hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy, and it's quite likely, in fact, just about inevitable, that we've got neighbors out there. And if they would, you know, carry some hardware here and some people here to study what's going on the Earth, Mars would be a very suitable place for them to be. So if at some point somebody said, yes, we found structures and cities, and they were able to prove that, then it's very much likely that these would be from, you know, travelers from another solar system and not our own.
That's fascinating, though, nonetheless, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, you know, if you really wanted to look for signs of intelligent life in space, many people say, well, let's look for radio waves. And, of course, technical civilizations do tend to make radio waves, we think. We certainly do. But as I'd like to point out, we're doing things that cut away the amount of radio emissions we produce on the Earth. Like, we're going to fiber optics and computer communications on the ground. And eventually, it could be that we produce so little radio wave that nobody would detect it. But a funny thought occurred to me a couple of weeks ago, and it was this. We're working on orbital power satellites, and they would broadcast probably in the microwave band. No matter where in the universe you live, that's an easy thing to do. Perhaps what we should look for is broad, steady microwave signatures. Because if there are technical civilizations around other planets, maybe they're using orbital power systems, and that would be a signature of them.
Do you think we need to go back to Mars?
I'm certain we do, because once we find the history of the planet in any great detail, we're going to discover many parallels with our own planet, and we can learn a lot from that. But not only that, imagine finding alien organisms. Medical applications alone would be amazing. I'm certain we'd find new drugs and chemicals that we could use for treatment of diseases we have here on Earth.
I think so, too. I also think they will find some incredible similarities between all the planets in the solar system. You know, we're all made out of the same elements, aren't we?
Well, yes, we are. And that's one of the most important points to make. Our solar system was formed at one time out of all the same materials. And essentially, only two things determine the history of a planet: how far it is from its star and its mass. And the more mass the planet has, generally it will turn into eventually something that sucks up a lot of gas and dust and becomes like a Jovian planet,
exactly.
A gas giant. And if it's smaller, it'll be a terrestrial world. But the farther you are from a star, the more volatile materials such as ice, ammonia, and methane that your planet will pick up. And the closer you are, the more that material will be baked away. So those two constraints will determine almost everything about a planet's history and its future.
Isn't it amazing, Charles, at how water seems to be all over the solar system, maybe all over the universe?
Well, it is. It is all over the universe. And it's one of the most pervasive molecules, and there's a very simple reason for that. When a star explodes and scatters all of its materials into the universe around us, one of the most common products is oxygen. And in the universe itself, the most common element is hydrogen. It is inevitable that hydrogen and oxygen out in the depths of space will come together and form water molecules. So you're going to find it everywhere in the universe.
Do you think we have oceans of water in the universe just floating along?
Well, I don't think that you'll find liquid oceans of water floating around in the universe, because if they're in space, the material will evaporate. You'll get ice crystals and you'll get water vapor.
Okay.
But there will be huge clouds of molecules. Those have been detected by radio telescope. In fact, there's alcohols, water, ammonia, all kinds of stuff out there.
I was flying from San Jose a couple weeks ago over clouds. And now here's a question that I want to ask somebody who may know. You may know. You look at all these clouds below your airplane, and they're stationary, yet, you know, it's just gas. You could just, you know, if you dropped something, it would go right through it. What keeps that cloud in the form that it's in, and it's not blowing all over the place? Because we know the speeds of the wind up there are, you know, 70, 80, 90, maybe 100 miles an hour.
Well, actually, that's pretty simple. Imagine if you were in a balloon, a hot air balloon, and you're moving along. You're moving at the same speed that the air around you is. It's carrying you with it. So even if you're in a 70-mile-per-hour wind in a hot air balloon, if the wind is undisturbed, you don't feel any difference.
Okay, but a balloon is physical, okay?
That's true.
A cloud is not, really.
Well, it is physical, but it's just scattered in tiny particles. All the particles are being carried along at the same speed as the air itself, just as the balloon would be. And what you're seeing when you see a cloud is a zone but the temperature and pressure and humidity are just right for condensation. So the cloud isn't the thing. It's the zone of air pressure and temperature and moisture. The cloud simply shows you where it is.
The sun is still pretty inactive these days.
Yes, we've got one of the quietest solar periods we've seen in quite a while. Almost no sunspots. It's an amazingly quiet period. And the thing about that is, when we have no sunspot activity, the weather on Earth actually cools off. That could be to our favor.
I think so, too. It could cool off quite a bit. There are some who think we're in the beginning of an ice age. Would you?
You know, that's an interesting thought, and that's been kicked around for a number of years. And over the last couple of years, the 70 years of temperature gains we've seen have been completely wiped out. You know, many science fiction authors have written about that subject. What if we actually were in an ice age and our industries were actually staving it off for a while? I don't think there's any way of really knowing until we get there. But it is an interesting thought, and we could very well be in a cooling period right now.
Charles, what got you so fascinated with space?
You know, we're in space right now. We just don't see it because we're stuck on the Earth.
That's right.
I think it's because that's where everything is. And, you know, as a child, I was fascinated by everything, and I wanted to know the questions and the answers. And the only bad thing is the more answers you learn, the more questions you get. I guess it could be a bad thing, but I've enjoyed it. Space has everything in it, and it has all the answers in it, if we just know how to look.
Tell me about your knighthood. How did that happen?
Well, I was doing a lot of research, and particularly research in nuclear fusion. And as a result of that, I was approached by the Baron of Balquhane, Dr. Nelson Ying. And he came up with the money and the title. And basically, he bestowed the title on me and gave me the 5-year research grant as a result of the work that I had done. And it allowed me the great intellectual freedom to study things and to work on things. And the only stipulation he had was whatever I did could not be weapons related. And that was easy to do. Very simple.
You know what? I'm glad he did that. There aren't a lot of people who would request that.
Well, you know what? He is a real philanthropist. And so much that I've done since then has been dependent on his goodwill. And it makes you think. So many people expect something out of life, and they never put anything back.
Exactly.
And he has paid forward so much. And as a result, some of the work I've done has had some effects and implications for other people. And I think that that's one of the most important things we do in a society. It's one of the things that defines us as a human being, our altruistic tendencies.
And you don't stop. What keeps driving you?
You know, I don't think there is an end. When you do stop, they need to bury you. The drive to learn and to do well and to help people, I think, is just, it's a part of our being. And I just have been fortunate enough to be able to live that and to respond to it. I've got the best job in the world. I get to find a problem, nail it down, experiment with it, and find a solution. And you can't ask for more.
I would duel you for that honor. I think I have the best job in the world. And it's good that we think that, isn't it?
You know what? It's great that we both agree that we enjoy what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If you had NASA's ear, maybe you do, what would you tell them about the current space shuttle program?
Well, you know, the shuttle really does need to be retired, and there are alternative vehicles. And there are spacecraft that we have on the production line that could be man-rated very easily. You know, there's even there's a rumor right now they're going to bring the old Russian Buran space shuttle back and use it for a while.
Jeez.
But the shuttle really has gone way past its limits, and it's time that we got to a new vehicle. It's time we concentrated not on putting 100,000 pounds of stuff up there every time and bringing it back, but on putting something permanent up there and then only sending up the people and machinery we need to do the experiments. I mean, we could cut the costs to 5 to 10% of what we're paying for a shuttle flight right now.
And this current problem with the Endeavor, this hydrogen fuel leak, I think this is indicative of the fact that these things are old.
Well, they are very old. Do you know how large the fuel and oxidizer lines from the shuttle to the external tank are? They're 17 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
And every time they hook the thing up, they have to get an absolutely leak-proof seal that's going to take acceleration forces and torsions and vibration. You know, when they dump that external tank, there's roughly 5,100 pounds of fuel and oxidizer just in the pipes. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is. But it's also scary. It's scary to think of those astronauts who sit aboard that thing, and these little problems can turn into huge problems.
Well, yes, they can. It can be catastrophic from a very small thing. I mean, look at the insulation on the Apollo 1 test and what happened.
Oh, yeah.
You know, absolute disaster.
Truly a tragedy. I had a great opportunity a few months ago of sitting next to Edgar Mitchell at a dinner in Washington, D.C., and he confided that he'd like to go back up into space one more time. He wants to beat John Glenn's record for age.
Well, you know, that's an admirable thought, and it could happen. There are many commercial space entities that are actually practicing now. They're actually launching things, and so that could happen. You know, for instance, SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, they started from a standing start, and in a five-year period of time designed an entirely new liquid fuel rocket engine. And the amount of money they spent in that five-year project to develop and fly this engine is the same amount of money that NASA spends in 11 days.
And you know that spaceport is starting to be worked on now,
well,
too.
Well, I'm near the spaceport right now.
Oh, are you?
I'm moving my business. I'm in Truth or Consequences as we speak, and I'm getting ready to set everything up out here specifically because of the spaceport.
That could be the hub.
Well, yes, it could, and I've got some very good reason for it, and I'll go into that in greater detail when we start talking about the energy ends of things.
Absolutely, which we're going to do when we come right back from this break, Sir Charles. In your website, would you give it out to us, please?
Yes, xenotechresearch.com, xenotechresearch.
Our special guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz III, will be right back as we get into some of these emerging technologies. Get up to coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at the animated photograph that Sir Charles sent us of the solar electrical-powered machines. They're really incredible. We'll be back in a moment. Well, find out why thousands and thousands of people recently are joining Streamlink. They're getting podcasts and downloads, and they're just having plain old fun for pennies a day. Go to coasttocoastam.com and figure out how it works, and then sign up for Streamlink. So, Charles, you tie our current situation with the economy into this need and this urgent push for alternative energy sources. Tell me a little bit about your take on just how badly you think we've been hit.
Well, you know, at this point, so many people are losing their homes and have no jobs to turn to that I don't know if we'll ever recover with the bailout situation. And the bailouts aren't really helping things.
No.
If we didn't have bailouts, people wouldn't be waiting to make a decision about what to do. They would proceed with their life as usual. I mean, we came out of the Great Depression, and we came out of it stronger. And so when people hand money out, a lot of companies will put on hold a decision about what they're going to do, waiting for their piece of the pie. So it really isn't doing us a great deal of good. And, you know, you think about people like Madoff, who got $50 billion, and how much money that is and how much good that could have done. The money didn't just vanish. Somebody out there has $50 billion.
Yeah, somebody's got it.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's doing something, and you don't know who for or what it's doing. And to put it in perspective, that's enough to buy about 30 Apollo moon ships.
That would have been a nice little moon trip for us, wouldn't it, huh?
Yeah, that's a huge amount of money. I mean, if he simply gave it to people, he could make 1,000 millionaires in each one of all 50 states.
Well,
that's an awful lot of money.
How do we dig our way out of that?
And the answer to that's actually very simple. Wealth doesn't fall out of the sky. You make wealth, generally from raw materials or from your knowledge. And so we have the ability within our hands to turn our entire economy around using the one thing we have more of than anybody else, and that's technical knowledge. We can put science to work to rebuild our economy very easily. And so there are three specific things that come to mind. And the first, of course, is energy. The second is water and water management, because you can't have life without water.
Right.
And the third goes to medical technology. And we'll talk on, you know, medical stem cell research in particular, because it has huge things that are happening. And I see that if we were to put a technical push, rather than throwing money at the auto companies and the banks, put a technical push into developing these technologies, the benefits we could get out would be immense, and we'd come out, in the end, far better than we are now.
And we'd create lots of new jobs.
Well, exactly right. You know, money doesn't just sit there and get used up. If you know what you're doing, money makes more money. And so that's what we should be doing. So I'm going to touch on all three of those in depth and tell people just exactly what we need to do.
All right, tell me about this animated picture you sent us that we have posted at coasttocoastam.com now.
Well, my company, as you know, developed this solar thermal generator concept, and we were hoping to go to production with it. Well, of course, you know, economics being what they were, it didn't happen. So in order to avoid any legal difficulties, I developed a whole new way of doing it, and in doing so, came up with a means of putting it in a pod. So now, instead of having the huge machine that some of the viewers saw on the website from the previous show I did, I have an object that you can basically hold in your two hands, and you put focused sunlight on the end, and electricity comes out of the end. So we're now in the final stages of figuring out exactly how to get all of it packaged in the box. That's a computer render of what it's going to look like. And you'll essentially just put a lens at the front of it and that pod at the bottom of it, and electricity will come out to power whatever you need.
Whatever you need?
That's correct.
You can generate that kind of power?
Well, yes. It'll be able to run your home or your lights or whatever, and if you need more of them, you buy more units.
That's incredible.
Well, you know, things have to be plug and play. They have to be as simple as they can be these days. And in fact, that's the reason I'm down in this area right now. I'm doing some work with Space Island Group, and I know you've heard of them before, G. Meyer's company.
Yeah.
Well, they've received authorization to put a pilot orbital power station up in October of 2010. So the orbital power station concept will be tested then. They're already working on it.
Is this with a big solar panel?
Yes. The first one will be photovoltaic. Later ones may be, or they may be using the technology that I'm working on. So we're negotiating the technologies I'm going to provide for the project now. And I'm moving my company to the spaceport area so I can be manufacturing here some of the projects, you know, some of the products they'll need for their project and some of the products people will be using to power their homes.
Interesting. And what will they do? How do you get the energy back down to the planet with something like that?
Well, the orbital power station, they've selected a microwave frequency that doesn't interact with the atmosphere or the environment, and they have a tuned antenna that will be on the ground, and the beam will be received by the antenna. And subscribers on the Earth will be able to, just like you get a like an XM radio subscription, mm-hmm. they'll be able to get a subscription to their electrical power. And the utility grids or the utility companies will buy that broadcast power and put it right in the grid for you.
Have you seen what Nokia is doing with one of their upcoming cell phones?
Oh, yes. You know, it's amazing.
You won't have to charge it anymore. It literally takes energy out of the atmosphere.
And they're broadcasting the power for that phone.
And, yeah. Charges it right up that way. Then
exactly
didn't
the
Nikola Tesla try to do that?
Well, he actually was quite successful, and just within the last couple of years, some universities have been duplicating the effect, and they've been able to broadcast with efficiencies from point to point that rival copper wiring. And pretty soon they feel they should be able to surpass that. So within a few very short years, we'll probably see the case where all of the big power towers are going to vanish and we'll just broadcast from one point to the other. And that'll be a part of the grid now.
It could change if we wanted to. The problem is there's too much greed out there, Charles. I mean, I went to the pump here in L.A. We're up to $3.25 a gallon now.
Oh, premium. I know. You know, this was only a temporary alleviation for our ills, and now it's right back to, you know, it's heading right back to where it was.
Yeah, we can't afford gasoline at these prices.
Well, no,
we're getting out of this kind of mess we're in.
But understand something. They're cutting their own throats by raising the prices because people like myself and other companies are developing alternatives.
Absolutely. And they're going to crush the automobile industry.
Well, yes, it could. It could. But there are alternatives, and they're down the pipe right now.
Let's talk about these three areas. Of the energy, water, and medical technologies, which is the most important, or are they all three?
Well, I would say they're all three important, but I'd start with energy because energy powers everything. I mean, why don't we mine landfills? Because we don't have the energy to reprocess the equipment, you know, the material and the garbage in there. And why don't we have plenty of fresh water? Because we don't have the energy to run desalination plants at a reasonable cost. So it all really comes down to energy. I mean, if we have energy, we have enough intelligence and expertise to do everything else.
Are you a supporter of windmills and things like that?
Well, yes, I am. And, you know, one of the things that really interested me was the wave technology. Many people talk about harnessing the ocean waves. And as it turns out, that's even being done. In California, they've got a 2-megawatt system that's being installed. And in Hawaii, they've got another one that's being installed. In fact, by November of last year, they had 3 of the units installed, and they're adding more right now. So wave energy, they figured to put 6% of their power on the grid right there, and it's environmentally clean. And for wind, I've been doing some research over the last 4 months. I designed and built 4 different models of windmill, and I started with the basic principle, you know, looking for something more effective. And so I built and tested all 4 of these models, and I've arrived at something that is completely different. And the best way to describe it is it's an air diode. It allows air to flow in one direction only, and it's amazing about the efficiency. And that's one of the products we're going to be manufacturing.
Does it have fins?
It has blades sort of like a fly swatter.
Really? Okay. Are you carbon fibers, or what's the material?
It could be made out of anything, and I'm going to be using composite materials for any of them that are used in areas where there's aircraft radar, so we don't have any problems. I know that many radar issues were raised by the Defense Department because of wind installations.
But you're right. Do you know how easy it would be to fund this if this country wanted to?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it just takes a small nominal amount of money to get some project like this going when you find an entrepreneur that has a good product. And the issue is many people come up with interesting ideas for power or, you know, water or whatever. But in the end, very few of those ideas actually have prototypes built and actually work. And then after that, they go through a filtering process. Very few of them actually ever get funded. I mean, less than 1% of those ideas ever comes to fruition. But it's worth the investment because the handful at work can revolutionize everything we do.
Martin in Albany writes, Sir Charles, what about the research being done using non-photovoltaic solar energy?
Well, that's exactly what mine is. It's non-photovoltaic. It's thermal.
Okay, and he's talking about solar reflectors heating a liquid, such as water, to steam and using the steam to drive a turbine.
Exactly. In fact, the machine that I built in Farmington last year was a steam turbine that ran on solar energy. And, you know, the thing about it is the materials are not that hard to understand. The systems are simple enough that an auto mechanic can generally fix them. And you don't have to have a silicon foundry or a semiconductor factory to make the systems. But then on the other hand, there are new materials coming out now that allow you to make fairly low-cost solar cells. And so we're going to see both approaches, depending on what works best in a given area.
What do you think will be the most dramatic change in terms, and we're still on the energy category here of the three, what do you think will be the most dramatic change in the next 5-10 years?
Storage systems, definitely, because we can generate all kinds of energy. We can generate and capture energy from anything.
Capacitors, basically, right?
Well, basically, yes. It looks like a form of capacitor would probably be our most effective. And they're working on, you've seen supercapacitors, but they've got a new thing that's just even more amazing. And it's a type of carbon material, similar to the nanotube, but it's very, very fluffy. And it makes a supercapacitor that they really class as a hypercapacitor. And it will compete with the battery. Now, there are other technologies for storing energy, and one of them that's gotten a lot of play lately is compressed air. And because, believe it or not, a windmill can run an air compressor.
There's a car in France that runs on compressed air, but they say it uses too much.
In France and Italy now that run on compressed air.
Now, they say, though, it uses too much energy for the compressor. Is that true?
Well, that is the energy hog. You know, understand when you compress air, the air gets very hot, and that heat has to go somewhere, and that's a loss. So, yes, there is a loss there. But if you're running it off something that runs on, let's say, wind power, like a windmill, they've already been used to pump water, and they've already been used to pump air compressors. So if it's running off wind, you don't particularly care about the cost of the energy because it's generating it from wind anyway.
When do you think everybody will have their own little unit by their house so we don't have to, you know, worry about the electric company?
Oh, well, you know, I'd like to see that in a year or two. That would put me in a good position because
really? That's
what I'm manufacturing, little power units.
Yeah.
But, you know, the big issue here is you can buy all sorts of generating equipment, but storing that energy generally means you either have to have a lot of batteries or you have to be tied to the grid and sell the excess back.
Right.
So we're going to see a major change as soon as the new capacitors come along, and they're definitely working on them, and I expect to see something. I would say within the next 6 months, expect a breakthrough in capacitor storage.
You know, it's possible if we can come up with this soon, what a tremendous change it would be. Here's an example. We had a storm roll through St. Louis just a few days ago. You know, it took out a lot of power. Power lines went down. If everybody had their own little unit, we wouldn't have that problem, would we?
That's correct. Everybody would be independent. And that's another issue. You know, we talk about security for our country. Well, it's very easy, and it's demonstrated that parts of our power grid were compromised. And so that's a real threat because somebody could come along with a virus or, you know, some malware and influence whether the power grid runs at all in some cases. So we need the ability to cut our homes from the power grid in, you know, times of need and be able to run independently. I mean, that gives us national security more than anything else.
Absolutely. Let's move into the water area. Wars will be fought over water, no doubt. You agree?
Absolutely right.
Yep.
You know, water is essential to life. No matter where in the universe you are, if you have liquid water, you can have life. And on our planet, the thing that determines where people live on the entire planet is the supply of fresh water. So you need water not just for your own life, but even for your crops and your livestock. Now, in this country, we don't see it. We go to the store, we buy something in a can, but at the bottom, at the root of it all, we still have to have that fresh water. And that's what's causing more warfare in parts of the world right now, water rights. And look at the economic and political football that water rights come to be in areas such as Arizona and here in New Mexico. It's very difficult to get fresh water.
Well, look at Las Vegas. Look what happens if the Colorado River ever dries up.
Well, the city's dead then.
City's dead. Los Angeles gets affected as well. It's a disaster of biblical proportions.
Well, it is. And so we need to have a system to produce plenty of fresh water. And we also have another issue that comes to mind from time to time. And you look at the floods and the disasters we've had over the last few years. I've thought about this, and there seems to be actually a very simple way of handling this. We need a system in this country, and perhaps this isn't workable, I don't know, but I think it's a wonderful thought idea, and it could provide an awful lot of benefit. We need a water management system that allows flood and drought control. For instance, consider in 1993 the massive floods we had. They covered North and South Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas.
Midwest, the Mississippi went up, and St. Louis got it.
$20 billion of damage in floods, $20 billion. And back in September of 99, in North Carolina from Hurricane Floyd, there was $6 billion of damage.
Yeah.
If we had a means of moving all that excess flood water to locations that needed it, we would have a means of controlling a lot of that damage.
How would we do that? A huge aqueduct?
Well, you know, we built an interstate highway system in a number of years that allows us transportation everywhere. What if we were to set up a system of the tunnel bores like we're used to make the tunnel between France and England, and we were to use them to dig aqueducts? Now, they would be underground. They would not affect the environment above ground. The pumping and moving systems could be run completely on wind and sun.
Interesting.
And when the system was not in use, those solar and wind generators could be putting power into our standard electric
grid. How long would it take to make that, Charles?
Well, you know, it might take 20 years to do. It might take 30. But I don't think that's even of a material concern, because all the time that that work is going on, number one, we're eliminating a lot of damage from floods and droughts by rerouting water where it's needed. And number two, we're employing our citizens.
Well, maybe you can have one lead straight to, like, Lake Mead or something.
You know, that's always a possibility. But consider the other side of this thing. If we were to build this huge control system, and again, it's completely underground and it's not going to affect the environment above ground, anywhere we have reservoirs that exist or we build reservoirs, water can be pumped into them, and then it can be used in times of off, you know, of off use as hydropower storage.
What about the possibilities of for drinking water, a huge desalinization plants along the coasts?
Well, and that can be done also. You know, it's very easy to create fresh water using nothing but sunlight. And if you were to have long troughs covered with a transparent material, and it could even be thin plastic film, you've seen the solar stills before.
Sure.
Well, absolutely. So we dig long ditches, we let the salt water in, and we have a clear plastic membrane over the top with a dimple all the way down the middle, and it catches fresh water for free.
And there it is.
And not only that, I've been approached by a group in Mexico about my 6-kilowatt solar furnaces that I'm going to be producing, and they want to use them to turn brine into sea salt. Now, they're doing it in natural drying trays now, but as I pointed out to them, if you use the solar furnaces to do it, you capture the evaporated water and you get fresh drinking water out of the deal as well.
Now, what's the kilowattage of the units that you've sent us the pictures of?
That is meant to be used with a 1.5 kilowatt unit.
And it'll
put out about 300 to 500 watts of power, depending on the conditions.
Which is, now, one unit could do what?
Let's see. If you were using compact fluorescents in your house, it would light your whole home very easily and run a couple of small appliances, like a TV, perhaps. And, you know, a lot of people don't use as much power these days, specifically because their bills are so high.
And where would you put these? Up on the roof?
You could put them on the roof. You could put them in your backyard. And the most interesting thing about a module of this type, and this is the thing that I really push to people, is you can buy one, and then a few months later, you can buy another. And down the road, you buy another.
They're like pods?
That's exactly right. And pretty soon, you've got a farm of these things, and you're producing more power than you consume. And the reason for this is simple. California enacted legislation saying that by a certain year, they wanted the housing to produce more energy than it consumed. And this would give them the ability to do that.
That's fascinating work. How do you think of this stuff?
You know, I don't know. I'm a sort of person that really does think out of the box. I take a sideways view at things. I look at things laterally, I guess. And I always ask questions that people don't think to ask. It's just kind of fundamental to the way I think.
Charles, I want to get into nanotechnology, the medical technologies as well when we come back. And then we'll see how and who is going to push this through. Are other countries ahead of us?
Yes, indeed. In fact, some things have been done in Colombia, I'll tell you about when we come back from the break, and it just will amaze you to hear.
All righty.